It's not on. It is now. Does everybody have sight of one of these sheets? I have a spare one here. Another one? Oh. Great. Well, good evening and thank you. I've split this evening into two sections. The first section is going to be about my vocational journey, which leads towards the pastoral placement that I did in Belmarsh Prison. So firstly, I'm going to talk about the vocational journey, and then in the second section, I'll talk about my pastoral placement in Belmarsh Prison, and then we'll have a question and answer time about that. The clock is behind me, so Liz is my timekeeper. Otherwise, we might be here all night. And I know this was entitled My Time in Belmarsh Prison, I think, but it could equally have been called It's All Ken's Fault. Ken Short, that is. About 2012, a year after my parents had died, I was preaching here at St. Michael's in the evening. And Ken came up to me afterwards very seriously and said, "You should be in the ministry, my dear." And I said, "But I am. I'm a business coach. And that is where God has called me to be, as a business coach out in the world." Anyway, people had been saying that to me for years. And I went home that night and it wasn't a sufficient answer. And it was as if God was saying, "Come on, Daphne, you've got time now. You can think about it. You need to, you know, think about this question properly." So I then went to the next most revered person in the congregation, that is our vicar. And Sandy said, "Well, why don't you go to a vocations day at Southwark Cathedral?" Which is what I did. And I spent the morning with other people who were thinking about what they wanted to do in the Church of England, and came away with a strong sense that ordination was it. Not being a reader, not being a spa, ordination. And as luck would have it, I was over 53 years old at the time, or 52, so I wasn't able to put myself forward as a full-time vicar with a parish, because I really didn't feel called to that. I felt called to be what's called a non-stipendiary minister, which means that the diocese kindly pays for my education for the next 3 years, and then when I've completed it and I'm in my curacy, I give my time in return, as it were. Now, I've put here a timeline and some criteria because many of us are members of the Church of England, and not many people understand how or why people arrive at the positions they're in and where they are. So I thought I'd just explain to you how rigorous the selection process is. And that's not to say that I'm a genius, because it's not. It's just to say that the Church of England is really rigorous about how it selects people. And there's a lot of form filling, which you can imagine. And I had to see a number of people. I had to see a vocations advisor, and I saw her twice. She said yes, and then it was deemed that she hadn't done the paperwork properly, so I had to do the whole process again. And it was a real lesson to me in patience. And what I understood, and I came to understand over the first 18 months, was that actually, it's not me that's choosing, it's me that's offering myself. And if those who are assessing me and interviewing me and putting me forward, it's their choice as to whether they prayerfully think that I'm appropriate as an NSM, as a vicar. So I went through a number of interviews, and then I finally got to see an area director of ordinance. So I used to trot over to Dulwich in the mornings and have a meeting with Bernhard Schunemann over there. And he asked me all sorts of questions about my education, just everything. And then I had to have three references, and the reference papers say you need somebody who has an educational background, somebody from the congregation, and somebody you've known from the business world. So I'm afraid, much as I love you all, I didn't choose anyone from the congregation. I chose my neighbour opposite, who isn't a Christian, professes no faith whatsoever, but I have known for the last 20 years. And I thought that would show a better reflection of who I am than just picking somebody who I know in the congregation who's someone like me who believes what I believe. And it was a bit of a risk, but it was fine. And I learned a lot from Liz about what she notices of me as a Christian out in the world, which I might not have learned otherwise. Eventually, there are 9 criteria that they're looking at, and you can see those criteria listed: vocation, ministry within the Church of England, spirituality, personality and character, relationships, leadership and collaboration, faith, mission and evangelism, and the really worrying one, quality of mind. Those are the 9 areas that you have to answer questions about, and you're asked the same question in different ways by different people at different times, so that the real truth comes out, amongst other things, but also so that you start to learn more about yourself. A big thing in the course that I'm doing is about my personal formation as a Christian, as a part of the body of Christ. And these 9 criteria help you to look at everything. The biggest challenge for me, you'll guess, is quality of mind. That was because I had had no formal education after my O-levels. I don't have a university degree. I haven't had any formal education. Well, I did A-levels but didn't pass them. And that was of great concern to everyone, mainly me. Would I be able to handle all the essays and the academic work? Because I'm not a big reader. So I went through all of that, and eventually you're invited to what's called a BAP, a Bishop's Advisory Panel, in May 2014. So that's sort of 18 months after I'd started the process. And at that 2.5 days, you are assessed from the moment you walk through the door till the moment you leave, at every point except during worship. So over meals, how do you mix with people? Do you go out and get drunk at the pub in the evening when everyone else goes out? How do you behave? What do you like with everybody? You then have an interview for 55 minutes on, 3 interviews for 55 minutes on the criteria. And they are grueling interviews, really nice conversations. But I wasn't asked once about mission and evangelism because my CV spoke for itself. The guy grilled me on my quality of mind for 55 minutes. It hurt. You have to give a presentation, you have to write a pastoral letter, and you have to answer a set of questions off the top of your head. Again, around the criteria, and again, a way of finding out that you are speaking about who you really are. So it's quite grueling, and it goes on for a long time. I'm now at the South East Institute for Theological Education. You can read all about that there. I'm not going to go through the whole lot. But I would just say that it has been terrifying for the first 9 months. I'm now nearly halfway through, and I'm starting to enjoy it. There are still lots of essays. I'm eternally grateful to you all for your support. And there have been treats from God along the way. I just want to tell you about 2 treats. One of them is Easter School in Canterbury, and we meet there for a week, all three school years, and we eat together, we stay together, we worship together, and we worship in the crypt of Canterbury Cathedral. And to lead Book of Common Prayer, Evensong, in the Canterbury Cathedral, even I was nearly speechless. It was amazing. And the second treat from God was At Easter, they'd clear the cathedral of all chairs. And we had a pilgrimage around there in the evening, just 17 of us. The doors were locked. We had a candlelit pilgrimage at night around the cathedral. And at one point, we were lying. I don't know if you've been to the cathedral, but in the middle, you look right up to the ceiling, up to the sky. We were lying on the floor, looking up at the sky, singing, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord." And it was amazing. So amongst all the hard work, there are lots of treats from God along the way. You can ask me questions about this afterwards if you want to, but I think we should move back now to our next phase so that we can then move into the Belmarsh question later, if that's all right. It struck me as I was thinking about my vocation how far back it is that God's been calling me. So that was my school hymn, and our headmistress was a Methodist. My Sunday school teacher was a Methodist. And people who've been influencing me all those years have brought me to this place, I think. So for the second part of the talk, I'll talk first, and then we'll have question and answer afterwards. I would ask you to understand that Belmarsh is a category A prison, and I have to be quite careful about some of the things that I say, and I must respect people's privacy, and I must respect the prison as a whole. So if I'm evasive sometimes, it's because I'm not sure of the answer, or I'm not sure that it's sensible that I know the right answer. I could make it up, you know me, but I'll try not to. So the way I'm going to approach this is to let you know why I chose this as a pastoral placement, what I did, when I did it, and what it was like. And then I'm coming to the end, three things that really struck me, and I now have to, after I've done this, write a report and a reflection, a theological reflection, on my time in the prison. So some general information about the prison. It's a men's prison, and it's a local prison, which means that it serves magistrates' courts in southeast London, and also the Central Criminal Court. As well as being a men's local prison, it's a Category A prison. You can look on the internet to find out what that means, but it's one of the most secure prisons that there can be. It was opened in 1991. It's down in Woolwich, in Thamesmead, where there are two or three other prisons, including a Young Offenders Institute. And it's run by the Ministry of Justice. It has a capacity of 910 inmates across four house blocks, what used to be called wings in a prison, if ever you've watched Porridge. They're called house blocks now, and they are 60% of the inmates are in multi-occupancy, and 40% have a single cell. And if you think about a prison, the best way to think about it is as a town in itself. So it's like a small town. It has a school, it has a gym, a hospital, a library, admin offices, it has a chapel, a dentist, a restaurant. Well, I'm not sure restaurant's stretching it a bit, but people eat. It has its own prison as well. There's a prison within a prison called segregation. So it has everything that we have out here, but in a more secure environment. There is a listener scheme for those who want a confidential ear. And that listener scheme is run by inmates who are called orderlies, who wear different uniforms, and they have listener written on their t-shirt. And if you want a conversation with them, you can have a confidential conversation. There are resettlement programs for people who are going back into the community. And there's detox for those who need it. Obviously, a lot of people go into prison because of drug-related issues. So there's detox for those who need it. And I went in to work with the Christian chaplain, responsible for the whole chaplaincy team. And he and his team are funded by the Ministry of Justice. The chaplain's called, he calls himself Trev the Rev, Trevor Jacquet. And I had to be with him, and I had to do a placement for 30 hours. And I had to be accompanied at all times, for obvious reasons. And afterwards, I now have to show some understanding of the structures of the institution. I have to be able to critically reflect on it, for the various theological models of ministry. I'm meant to come out with a deeper understanding of my own strengths and weaknesses in approaching different people in different situations. And I'm meant to be developing more self-awareness in an unfamiliar context. And prison is fairly unfamiliar to me. So why did I choose a prison placement rather than the NHS? Many of my colleagues were going to go to the NHS to be chaplains, and I was encouraged in that direction, but I didn't go down there in the end. Partly because of my previous young offender work. I've been to young offenders institutes all over the country, really, and some open prisons, but I'd never worked with adults in that situation. And when I met my first vocations advisor, he said, "You never know, you could end up in prison ministry." And that never occurred to me. And that has never left me, that comment. So I felt that I had to listen to what he was saying, and I had to listen to that. And I had to convince the college that this was the place I should be. And I worked with my tutor on convincing them. What I wanted to do was to understand and see something of how this whole multi-faith thing works in a prison. And I wanted to see it at a very practical level, because the media sends us all sorts of messages, tells us all sorts of things. I have no idea if they're true or not. And I wanted to see if I could find anything out for myself. So I went in across a number of days. I did 40 hours. Trevor didn't have time to lock me in a cell, but that was one of the things I would like to do at some point, is to be locked in a cell for half a day. Just half a day would be enough, I think. I went in on a Sunday to start with, and I did a Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday so that I could experience a wide variety of the activities that go on. So what did I do? Well, on the Sunday, I went in to the Roman Catholic service in the morning. There's a chapel. Let me explain. The chapel is probably about as big as this area, and it's slightly bigger, and it seats about, I don't know, there's probably about room for about 100 and something in there. And there are between 50 and 90 at the Roman Catholic service and then the Anglican service afterwards. So I went to those two services, which were both communion services, and I'll tell you more about that later. I then went back and I assisted with the Alpha course that they run there, which is Alpha, but it's not exactly like Alpha. But the day I went, they were learning about prayer, and I assisted in a small group discussion. Then they have a deeper learning on the Thursday afternoon. They have a deeper learning section where people can come who want to dive into the Bible quite deeply. And a gentleman came in he's a Baptist guy, came in from another church, and he had this massive tome, a theological book, and I looked at it and I thought, blimey, I'm terrified. I didn't want to look at it. I don't quite know if everyone does read it, but anyway, we were meant to be looking at that in the afternoon. And that was quite interesting because we were having worship. The worship runs with a tape recorder, and you choose the music you want. We don't have you, Peter, I'm afraid. So you have to choose the song, and then you press the button, and off you go and sing it. So I led part of that worship, which was really interesting because the inmates choose the songs, and off we go, and we talk about the songs as we go, and that's kind of how they learn, really. I did some admin while I was there. I love a bit of admin. And there's a project that's run by churches outside the prison called the Angel Project, where prisoners can write the names of their children and the present they'd like for their children to have. And this charity gives the children the presents as if they're from their father. So you have to do a lot of admin to make sure that the right presents go to the right children and that the fathers actually have contact. A lot of admin around it to make sure that everyone is safe. One of the things I did was the daily rounds. So when prisoners are new and they come into the prison, they have an induction, I suppose you'd call it, where they're told how the prison works, what happens, And for those, sometimes you go around and you see them one-to-one in their cells. And I did that with the Roman Catholic priest, and I did it with the imam, and then I did the whole thing with the Christian chaplain as well. And that was really interesting to see the different styles that people go around. And very often you're speaking to somebody, there's a cell door and there's a little gap like this, and I'm not that tall, and it's just above my eye line really, and you can pull the trap door back, and you have to introduce yourself and shake hands through this trap door effect in the door. It's not always like that, but sometimes it is if you haven't had a chance to do one-to-one before. That was very interesting, so I did that. I went round every area of the prison. I didn't go into the kitchens, but I went to the segregation unit, which is for people who, it's like the prison within a prison. So if they've had a fight or caused trouble or anything, they get put into the segregation unit. And I went round the hospital wing as well, which is very secure, obviously. And if you're in the segregation unit or you're in the hospital unit, legally, it is required that you see a chaplain every day. So the chaplains have rounds. They must go around the segregation and the hospital wing. They make notes. The prisoners are really well cared for. If they're in danger in any way, those notes are taken. If they've been upset and they've threatened their lives or they've tried to take their lives or anything like that, they are really, really well looked after. They're looked at every hour or more if needs be. I was able to sit in a number of conversations with two conversations with lads who were in the depths of despair. And I had the privilege of sitting with them and listening to them about their sense of abandonment and all sorts of things. So I did that. I was allowed to speak to a prisoner. If you can imagine, when they have association, all the prisoners are out in a room the length of their house block, and there's a pool table, and there are chairs around the edges, and there's a telephone, and there are showers at the edge as well, and loos. And when they're in association, I was allowed to speak to a gentleman whose father had died 2 weeks previously. And Trevor, the chaplain, had enabled him to go to his father's funeral. And it was the most moving conversation. And he was so grateful to the chaplaincy, who knew that he was in distress, spoke to the undertaker, spoke to all the right people, spoke to the governors, got permission for him to go out with two wardens. And he would have been handcuffed for his father's funeral, but he was able to go. And it was the most moving thing to see how chaplaincy really impacts people's lives in a positive way. The thing that really struck me was that when Trevor gave the talk, to the induction talk to sort of 15 new prisoners just in the night before, he said to them, there are three things you need to think about: your mind, your body, and your soul, your spirit. And he said, I'm a vicar, so I'm biased, I'm going to talk about God, but we won't shove religion down your throat, but if you want it, we're here. But we're here to listen anyway. Get yourself into education, use your mind. Get yourself exercising, use your body. Those are the three things you need to hold on to. And he was very honest about what time means in the prison. Because some people are there for a week, a year, 18 years. Some people might be going out the next day, you don't know. So he's very careful about how he handles time, but he was clear that they must organise themselves so that their minds, their bodies, and their souls are stretched. So that was really interesting, I thought. And then one day I was standing in the kitchen, the chaplaincy kitchen, and this little voice said to me, excuse me, miss, don't I know you? And I thought, gosh, do I know you? And I realised I did. He was one of the young lads I used to work with on the ferrier before it was knocked down. And there he was, and it was lovely. I mean, it wasn't lovely to see him there, but it was really lovely that he recognised me, and he talked fondly of the time when I was with Youth for Christ, and he used to come to tea and things like that. So one of the things about prison is that you have to be really sensitive. Well, I felt I had to be really sensitive to their privacy. So you never ask a prisoner how long they're going to be in for, and you never ask them why they're there. It's just not the done thing. So those are the sorts of things I did. I attended a chaplaincy meeting. So the chaplaincy group meet together once a week, but they meet all the time. I went to the admin offices and I went all over the place. And I felt, what was it like? Well, I felt like I'd come home. I know that sounds weird, but after you've been through security, and it's very, very strict security, fingerprint security, I came out the other side and we walked into the main prison further in, and I just had this overwhelming sense of arriving home. And the gardens were fairly nice, the sun was out, and it just felt as if I'd come home. It did feel quite weird being a female. There are female prison officers, and I was very conscious of my dress code, so I always wore sort of plain clothes, not much makeup. I tried to be as sort of in the background as I could be. And I was very conscious of providing privacy for people. So when we went to visit a prisoner in their cell, we would knock on the door. Everyone's called Mr. Smith, Mr. Bloggs, Mr. Brown. That's how they're addressed. It's all very respectful. And I think it comes across as a community that's learnt to live with itself, a bit like we have to learn to live with ourselves. Prison's pretty much the same. They're sort of muddling along and learning to live with themselves like all other human beings. And going into somebody's cell is very, very private. So when we did, we asked permission. Is it okay if I come in, explain who I am, and then sit down as usually a chair for me, and the chaplain would sit on the bed with Mr. Whoever we were visiting. And it was very moving. And one of the other things that I did was I learnt that Belmarsh is always held up as a really violent, awful place to be, with massive radicalisation, and you know, we're led to believe it's a ghastly place. Well, it's not as ghastly as it's made out to be. I want to reassure you. I never felt threatened at any stage. It's not completely safe, and you go into segregation and there's some pretty angry, upset people there. But I would say that it was, for the people who get on with it, it's a prison. It's never going to be lovely, but it's not the horrible place that people make it out to be, as far as I can work out. It was emotionally draining being in there, I can tell you that. Being close to so many people who know the mistakes they've made, can't admit them, don't want to admit them, struggle with how they are, it's very emotionally draining. And it made me realise how important it is for all chaplains, vicars, etc., who minister to people at a spiritual level, how much they need time and space to recharge their batteries when they're looking after people in such a difficult situation. Right, three things that really struck me. The first day, singing in the Anglican service, there were 90 blokes standing up, and we were singing Guide Me, O Thou Great Jehovah. Great, rousing song with the old music box on, and it was fantastic. Got to the last verse, Trevor turned the music off and he said, right chaps, visitor in the house today, Daphne's here, we're singing this unaccompanied. And they sang, and I couldn't sing, I was nearly in tears. It was like I was being sung to by angels. It was amazing to see, to feel that and to be there was extraordinary. And at the time of the peace, it reminded me that the only place in the world where there's a level playing field is at the foot of the cross. And we shared the peace. I knew nothing about them. I just knew that God loved them and he created them in his image. They knew nothing about me. We knew nothing about each other, but God knew everything about each of us. And it was the most amazing experience to be at the foot of the cross, level playing field, with guys who I have no idea what they'd done. And I wasn't in a position to judge anyone. And the second thing is that I was talking to Trevor and he said, the thing is, when you're an evangelical white middle class young lady or man, you come into a prison and you think you're bringing God with you. Well, he said, the fact is, when I open that prison door, I meet God. And that has challenged me greatly. And that's why we sang what we sang tonight, because God is there already. I mean, I know that in my heart, but we forget that sometimes. So that was a real challenge to me that I need to keep working on. And the other thing that struck me is about time. In my business, I'm a bit of a time expert. I work with people on making more of their time. And it struck me that people in there are doing time. And a week can feel like 14 years if it's your last week in prison, because you think you're never going to get there. And 10 years can seem like forever if you are going to be there for 10 years. So time is a really interesting thing about prison. And there are interesting things that happen to people's minds when they're in there, I think. So the angel singing to me, God meeting me as I open that cell door, and time were the three things that struck me the most. So you can now ask me some questions. Have we got 5 minutes for questions? Good.
Did you meet anybody who sort of denied that they were guilty of a crime?
Did I meet anyone who denied that they were guilty of a crime? Yes, a lot of people, like all of us, say, I didn't do it. A bit like Adam and Eve, really. Blame somebody else. So, yes, I did. Plenty. Do the same myself as well.
So, you think our courts are safe?
I'm not in a position to comment about whether our courts are safe or not. All I'm here to do, Stuart, is to talk about my vocation as a vicar and as a chaplain ministering to people. So the chaplaincy isn't there to work out whether the people are innocent or guilty. They are there to serve the people who are in there.
Daphne, you asked about, you talked earlier about the multi-faith aspect and how interested you were in that. Do you want to expand on that a bit and say what you learned about that?
The multi-faith aspect, thanks Stephen. Yes, I learned that the Muslim chaplaincy cook a great lunch. I had the most delicious curry. And their office is very neat and tidy. They have a lot of volunteers who come in. And going around with Riz was hilarious. He's a great guy. And I noticed that I think there's an understanding of the differences with our faith, but there's also, a bit like when I used to work on the Ferrier, the churches that used to work together at Holy Spirit Church, we never argued about doctrine or anything because we were too busy feeding people. And that's true in prison. There are too many young men and older men who need to be looked after spiritually and pastorally to worry about whether we believe the same thing or not. Obviously there are differences. And what I noticed was a real equity as we went round. I went round with Riz and we'd done three or four new inmates. And he said to me, right, Daphne, he said, you've seen three or four. Do you want to do the next one? Looks like a Christian. Oh, blimey, yeah, all right then. So I did the induction and I noticed how fair everyone was. And Trevor, the chaplain, if we met a Muslim, he would say, look, you need to know which direction east is. When you're praying, you need to pray in that direction. If you get moved to the other side, you need to pray over there. Everybody was really fair about faith and respectful. And when you arrive in prison, you are asked, which religion would you like to choose? Very, very clear, which religion would you like to choose? You're told you don't have to choose one, but if you want to, you can, but it is your choice. So there's a real feeling about respect there. And somebody mentioned at coffee this morning, oh, radicalisation. Well, I don't know anything about that, but what I did see was a real love for one another at a chaplaincy level. So the chapel on a Friday for Friday prayers, all the Christian symbols and things are covered out or covered over, and it's made up to look like a mosque. And I just noticed a great respect for everybody. Because, as I said, it's a community learning to live with itself. And actually, I think they do that particular side of it quite well. Ken.
You mentioned Islam and... Was that right?
Christianity.
Roman Catholic.
Roman Catholic. I count them as Christians.
The chaplaincy and people who come in,
yep.
They've got areas in which they work, like offices and rooms.
Good question. So there are three main offices. There's the Anglican section, Roman Catholic office, and the Muslims have their office. Then there are a couple of classrooms, and there's another office, and they have the Jehovah's Witness guy, I think, comes in once a month. The Jewish guy, I'm not sure how often he comes in, but whoever you are, I've got them all listed here, they can come in and use the chapel. They come in under the auspices of Trevor, so you have to go in through Trevor, who's the lead chaplain, and he approves people coming in and approves when they're going to come in. It's really complicated. If you want to go to church, you have to be on the list. Then if somebody's got aggravation with another person, you have to make sure they're not in the same service. There's a lot of admin around going to church.
So you enjoyed the Muslim cooking.
Yes. Well, Trevor doesn't seem to eat at all. He spends the whole day. But the lunch, when everyone's there, they're not always there because there are rotas and there are people on duty at different times, because some people are part-time, some people are full-time. So you don't always overlap. But when you do overlap, there's lunch in one of the rooms there, and there's a chaplaincy kitchen as well. So if you're there together, you eat together. Francis, you wanted to ask a question.
Last one. I'm sorry. This is. I'm not. I don't want to undermine anything you said. I thought your talks had been absolutely wonderful and very, very fascinating. You said that you met prisoners and you weren't aware what their crimes were, why they were imprisoned. How do you reconcile that with the commandment that says thou shalt not kill?
So the question is around not knowing what people have done and reconciling it with the commandment thou shalt not kill.
You said something very interesting about we are all equal at the...
At the foot of the cross, yes. We're all equal at the foot of the cross when we're before God, because he loves each and every one of us absolutely the same. Whatever we've done, he loves us identically. Nothing we can do will ever make him love us more than he already does, and nothing will ever make him love us any less. It's our responsibility to confess our sins and to go before God at the foot of the cross and know that Christ has died to forgive us. And we think about on the cross at Easter, the prisoner on the one side who recognizes who Jesus is, and he says, "Today you'll be in paradise with me." I knew what some of them had done at some points, and it is very important not to judge, because that is the job of the courts. And there is something which we can't go into now, but about forgiveness. And the idea is you go to prison, you serve your sentence, and you come out, and you are forgiven for what you've done, and you move on, and you try and change and make new habits and not go back to prison. I get the impression, and you only need to watch the Jeremy Kyle show, to see that there is a lack of understanding about forgiveness and a lack of forgiveness creeping into our world, where once you've sinned, you are a sinner forever and that's it. And do you know what? Even if you haven't done it, that's what the press is telling me you've done. You're guilty. And I think as Christians, we need to stand away from that and say that God will be the judge, ultimately, whether things are right or wrong. We are not to judge, we are to love one another. And that is what, as Christians, we do at the foot of the cross with Christ, dying for our sins so that we can be saved.
Traditionally,
thank you.
I'm sorry to butt in
again. Francis, can we come back to it afterwards? Because I'm just conscious of time, that's all. We've overrun a little bit. I'll be here after. Hereafter, that's very... Thank you.